from KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuliner. The shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri has received international attention for more than a week now. Missouri citizens have gathered in the city to protest the police department, the killing of an unarmed teenager, and racism within the community. These protests have turned violent with the looting and burning of Ferguson stores and forceful police intervention, including tear gas and the firing of rubber bullets. The name of the officer involved in the killing has been released. Today, autopsy results showed Brown suffered multiple gunshot wounds, including two to the head. And more information is known every day, but there's still a lot that is not known about the incident that resulted in Michael Brown's death. And the legal process going forward will be very important to a community that is crying out for justice now. Joining us in studio today to talk about the situation in Ferguson and where things go from here, Frank Bowman is a law professor at the MU School of Law. Frank, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here as always.
And joining us by phone, or by Skype rather, Camille Phillips is a reporter from St. Louis Public Radio. She's been covering the situation in Ferguson. Camille, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing.
And we'd like to hear what you think in our audience as well about the situation in Ferguson. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection at kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. So Camille, maybe you can update us a little bit for those that are just tuning in and haven't maybe been paying attention this morning. There have been some developments in this story today. One of those has to do with some of the autopsy information that's now being released.
Right. Yes. The autopsy is the information that has been released is from the private autopsy done by the ordered on behalf of the family by attorneys for the family. It's just preliminary, but it sounds like there were six gunshots, two to the head, and one of the ones to the head was sounds like the fatal shot.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. What they're saying now is that the six actual shots that hit the person. There isn't much else evidence yet because this is just specifically the autopsy, not the other information that's out there of how many shots may have actually been fired. But yeah, you also in the last day or so have been out at some of the rallies and things like that out in the community. What's been your impression about the mood right now in Ferguson?
Well, the thing about it is that there's a range of perspectives and a range of feelings. You know, there's a lot of people, of course, that are upset and are angry and want justice. But for the most part, it's people that are wanting to peacefully protest and get their message heard. There are, you know, a few people I've heard from that are less sure that peace is going to get answers. And there's a few, but they're the minority that are saying that that maybe violence has to happen. And we've seen some of that turnover at night. You know, it's been a cycle of peaceful protests during the day with big crowds, and then it turns a little violent at night. And last night was the worst so far.
Right. And we wanted to bring in a clip now, actually. Captain Ron Johnson is with the Missouri Highway Patrol, which has now been tasked with taking over the enforcement, especially at night, of some of these situations in Ferguson. And he gave a speech yesterday at a rally to call for justice for Michael Brown. Johnson is from that area of St. Louis. It was an impassioned speech, and he said he was very sorry to the community. He shared some personal stories from the situation, including talking to his son, who said he's an African-American 18-year-old who, you know, also wears his hat crooked sideways and has tattoos on his arms and says this is important for the future of this area. And so we wanted to play a quick clip from the end of that speech as aired on CNN yesterday.
And we all ought to be thanking the Browns for Michael. Because Michael's going to make it better for our sons so they can be better black men. So they can be better for our daughters so they can be better black women. Better for me so I can be a better black father. And we know they're going to make our mamas even better than they are today. Let's continue to show this nation who we are. Continue to show this country who we are. But when these days are over, and Mike Brown's family is still weeping, and they're still on their knees praying, no matter what positive comes in our lives, we still need to get on our knees And we need to pray. We need to thank Mike for his life. We need to thank him for the change that he is going to make and to make us better. I love you. I stand tall with you, and I'll see you out there. Thank you.
So again, that was Captain Ron Johnson with the Missouri Highway Patrol giving a speech yesterday at a rally to call for justice for Michael Brown. And Camille, I know you were arrived shortly after that speech on the scene there. What's been the impression of the community about that, and how is that affecting what's playing out?
Well, yesterday's rally was a lot like a church service, a worship service in some ways. You know, there were some heavy hitters there in the civil rights era. There was Jesse Jackson. There was Reverend Al Sharpton. There was Martin Luther King III there. And there were, worship songs. There were a lot of references to scripture. It was in a church service, and it felt like it in a lot of ways. And it was I think it really served to uplift people. And that's why it was such a contrast to Sunday night, just hours later. And the other interesting thing about last night, I'm not sure interesting is the right word, but the other change last night was that it started early. Gunshots were fired. Someone was wounded at 8:30. And so there were a lot of protesters out. It was several hours before the curfew started.
Right. Yeah. And so, but it's also, again, it kind of in contrast to Ron Johnson and the Highway Patrol took over mid last week after there'd been a lot of, this kind of militarized response from St. Louis County Police that had taken over the enforcement efforts there at night. Last night, definitely a sharp contrast to some of the more peaceful interactions that had happened when he took over last week.
Sorry. Yes. I was on scene on Sunday a week ago, and have been kind of covering this continuously since then. And what the cycle has been is that Sunday night a week ago was the first night where it started to get a little violent at night. That's when Quick Trip burned. And then from there, there was an escalation in police response. And then on Thursday night was the first and only truly peaceful night we had when Captain Ron Johnson took over and started marching with the protesters in the streets. Friday, there was a return to some looting. And then Saturday, it got a little worse. And then Sunday was the worst yet.
Right.
And so it will be interesting to see community response going forward to how they feel about Ron Johnson now after those contrasting, the speech where he said, "I'm with you." And then he talked there about how it's been a difficult 24 hours for him, and he just had to get back out there and keep going forward. And then obviously an even more difficult last night.
Right.
But sorry, I don't want to talk too much for you. But
there's
also the other side there. I've been speaking to a young man who has been out every night organizing some protests. His name is Tony Russell, and he called me about 9:30 last night and said, "I just want to make sure. Are you here? Are you on the scene? I want to make sure there's reporters out here because I've heard some of my people have been shot at by police." And he was really worried. He wanted to make sure that journalists were out there covering the real story. And as part of the problem that's going on here, it's so chaotic. There's always conflicting reports. People say there's gunshots being shot, and it sounds like it was actually rubber bullets, not real bullets. So it's people are really upset and scared and feel like they're not being heard, and they want the real story out there. That's from the protesters' perspective. And then there's the police perspective, where they feel like that there's this violence going on and they have to respond.
Right. I need to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. After more than a week of protests over the police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown, we're talking about the current state of the situation as well as social impact and the legal process as the community is crying out for justice. Now joining us in studio today to talk about the situation and where things go from here, Frank Bowman is a law professor at the MU School of Law. And joining us from St. Louis today, Camille Phillips is a reporter from St. Louis Public Radio. And for you and our audience, what questions do you have about the future of the situation in Ferguson? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And so, Frank, it's a good time to bring you in here, I think. So again, the community is calling for justice. Justice now is something that's being commonly seen on signs and chants, things like that. So assuming that justice means the prosecution of a police officer that, again, the details of that shooting are not very clear, what would that situation look like? How would that legal process likely have to play out?
All right. While one sympathizes very much with the cry for justice, the addition of the word now frankly makes that cry a little impractical because an investigation of this kind takes some time. And the time it takes isn't ordinarily visible in most kinds of cases because we're not sort of counting down the hours between, you know, an event and an indictment as we are here. But it takes time. There are things that have to be done, and indeed the length of the investigation is going to increase because of the national attention on it. Nobody on the law enforcement side, whether it's the state's attorney for the prosecuting attorney for St. Louis County, who's leading the state investigation, or the FBI and the Justice Department, who are looking into the matter federally, they are not going to want to make some premature determination here. They're going to want to make sure they've dotted every I and crossed every T so that they're not later accused of having blundered by being insufficiently thorough. So it's going to take some time. There are things that need to be done. And it's hard to send that message, I suppose, to angry young people, but things aren't quite as simple as they sometimes seem.
Right, right. I mean, there's been, again, back to those things that people are asking for in the situation. You know, they are wondering, why hasn't the officer already been arrested? You know, because, you know, there's a lot of concerns. This man's out roaming free. I've seen that on Twitter and heard that in some of the coverage as well. Again, how does that practically work when you're talking about enforcing something like this and possibly trying someone in that kind of situation?
Well, they're not going to arrest the officer unless and until an investigation's completed that concluded that he committed a crime. I don't know, but certainly protocol would suggest that he has long since been placed on administrative leave while the investigation proceeds. So he's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The question, though, is how long it's going to take to resolve the investigation.
Right, right. You mentioned that we've got these two investigations going. We've got St. Louis County prosecutor, Bob McAuliffe, and then we've also got the FBI investigation. Could you explain a little bit about those, I guess, the differences between those and one doesn't, like, FBI hasn't taken over. That's another thing that's been, I think, misreported. The FBI hasn't taken over this.
No, the FBI can't take over. The FBI has no authority, nor does the Department of Justice have the authority to take over a state investigation. In the law, we say that the state and the federal government are separate sovereignties, and each of them has the authority to separately investigate a single incident which may violate both state and federal law. So, it, for example, if you think back some years to the Rodney King beating by California police officers, there was a California state investigation. There was also a federal investigation. When the charged officers were acquitted by a state jury, the federal government stepped in and essentially filed criminal civil rights charges and undertook a separate prosecution. Some people might think, because they may have heard this phrase, wasn't that double jeopardy? No, it's not, because these are separate sovereignties.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, Camille, I wanted to bring you in on this, too, and you may be able to help us still, Frank, but there's also been a lot of talk about Bob McAuliffe as a prosecuting attorney. Some are asking that a special prosecutor be appointed. I guess maybe, Frank, actually you first. Would it make sense? Is that something, a step that could be taken in this situation? How common is that to happen? Some people are concerned about his ability to fairly prosecute this case.
Well, there has been a suggestion, for example, that the attorney general somehow or other take over this case. Well, under Missouri law, the attorney general cannot do that unless the local prosecutor makes a request that the Attorney General intervene. And as far as I know, that request has not been made. The prosecuting attorney in St. Louis County has said, in effect, my office is perfectly capable of handling this sort of case, and this case in particular, and I'm going to handle it. Mm-hmm. And so long as he takes that position, then he has the absolute right to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Camille, what else have you been hearing about that? And I guess just the sentiment that you know, the system may not work for this situation. I think that's something we're commonly hearing on the ground from protesters.
Right. Press conferences with the attorneys for the family, it sounds like they are pretty much pinning their hopes on the federal investigation, which would be under constitutional rights violations, civil rights violations, and the most likely charge there would be excessive use of force by the state.
Right, right. And so again, has there been a lot of this criticism of Bob McAuliffe too? Have you been?
Yes. There's been people calling, saying, "Why is Bob McAuliffe in this?" Because the thing is that Bob McAuliffe criticized the governor for calling in the National Guard and basically not the National Guard, sorry, but calling in the Missouri State Highway Patrol, saying he overstepped boundaries, that the county police was doing a fine job of, and so then there's been also been calls because evidently I think his father died. His father was a law enforcement and he died in the line of duty. So there's been some thought that maybe he has a conflict of interest there. But since it's not directly related to the case, legally he doesn't have a conflict of interest. And he is the only way to not have him be in charge is if he recuse himself. I think there might be something where a judge could call it, but the governor definitely could not just take over.
Right, right. I need to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. After more than a week of protests over the police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown, we're talking about the current state of the situation as well as the social impact and legal process as the community is crying out for justice now. Joining us today in studio to talk about the situation in Ferguson and where things go from here, Frank Bowman is a law professor at the MU School of Law, and joining us from St. Louis today by Skype, Camille Phillips is a reporter from St. Louis Public Radio. For you and our audience, what questions do you have about the future of the situation in Ferguson? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at @intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you, you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. We actually wanted to go ahead and play a clip talking about where things go from here. I mentioned that in the intro there. We had a team of KBIA reporters head down to Ferguson, or over to Ferguson, I should say, last week to the actual apartment complex where Michael Brown had been shot at 5 days earlier at that point. And the goal was to have conversations with young people there about the past and future of their town. Producers Austin Federa, Katie Heiler, Hope Kerwin, and Bram Sable-Smith spoke with the youth in Ferguson, and here is some of what they had to say.
My name is Paris Stanley, P-A-R-I-S-S-T-A-N-L-E-Y, and I'm 19 years old.
All right, my name is Ryan Addison, R-Y-A-N-A-D-D-I-S-O-N, and I'm 20.
Like, this is not something that's new. People scared of the police. You got a broken tail light, you think you're going to jail when you really get a ticket. You know, people scared. Oh, yeah, this was going to happen one way or another. Maybe not the same exact situation, the same person.
Or in the same place.
Or in the same area, but this was going to happen. You know what I mean? It's a lot of accusations and stuff being made, like, okay, all this rioting. I don't necessarily agree with it. I don't agree with the destroying of the property because this is the community I live in. I don't agree with that. But what do you expect a group of people to do when you take everything from them? All the time.
You don't give them no justice.
Don't give them nothing back. You don't give nobody nothing back. No justice. You just take. What you want us to do? I mean, what do you want people to do? And that's exactly what it's become. It's become people versus the law.
What's your name?
My name is Joshua Wilkes. If you walk down the side of the street, mind your own business. If you walk in two or three people in the group, they're stopping you or assuming that you did a crime or just wanted to check you for your ID for nothing. It's just, we've been going through that for years, and it's just finally somebody is able to hear the story and the things that we've been going through.
So you feel that if it weren't for the protests and the rioting, that a black kid getting shot by a cop in the street in St. Louis would not have been a story.
If it wasn't for the protests, it wasn't for the rioting, it would have just got swept under the rug like another DWI stop. I mean, a lot of opportunities that I see a kid, like the guy, he was finna start college Monday. So it's a lot of, we can't just say that we don't have no opportunities when we graduate. Our opportunities are cut short because of the police are murdering our young black youth. You know what I mean? It's just, we have a lot of opportunities. That shows you right there that they're doing something by graduating high school. The perfect thing that I want for all of this is for my young black generation, the youth, to come together and stick together and stop all the black-on-black crime, and for the police to do a better job in protecting and serving and stop harassing our young black youth. You know, it's just, I want more for my city than what it is now. It's just, it kills me that it takes this for everyone to come together in the community.
Do you mind if I ask your name?
Andrea. If I was to live in Chesterfield, which is like a white predominant area, I can't succeed there. I got to stay within my own county, within my own people to get anywhere. And that's just how St. Louis is, for real. So it's always been like this. It's been like this before we was even born. So it's not going to change anytime soon.
Yes, I'm Brandon. I just feel like they need to treat everyone with the same level of respect, regardless of race, because it's not a race issue. It's a justice thing. So many of us have gone through the same harassment from police, and if it escalates to a point to where he can get away with murder while your hands are in your urn, you're on your knees, then I don't feel like it can ever be right. But we can try to make a change.
The community has come together a lot more.
This is Tanisha Nesbitt.
It is sad that it has to be a situation like this for us to come together. Everything that's been going on, it's not, you know, everybody doesn't agree with everything. But how much can you take? We go through this every day. We get profiled just even by living in this area. It's like, now what do you do? We want justice, that's all.
Do you think you'll get it?
That's what we hope for, you know, like, I have a strong faith in God that he's going to, you know, make everything okay and that everybody's going to come together. You know, people are going to be brought to justice. I hope that. But, I mean, this is real life. I just want to be realistic in everything that I'm saying. We're just hoping that this time this is it. We're not taking it anymore.
So, a lot to unpack there from that 4 minutes of audio, again, from youth in Ferguson that we talked to last week, actually near the spot where Mike Brown had been shot about 5 days earlier. They were talking to KBI producers last week, producers Austin Federa, Katie Heiler, Hope Kerwin, and Bram Sable-Smith. So, Camille, I wonder, some of the things we heard there in that piece, if those are some of the same things you've been hearing from the people that you've been talking to there in Ferguson.
Yeah, a lot of it does sound familiar. You talk to different people. They have different definitions of what justice is. They have different ranges of what, you know, they hope can happen or believe can happen in response. Definitely there's a feeling that, you know, there needs to be conversation started or continued about how do we reach across, you know, divisions in the St. Louis region. And these aren't, like they were saying, these aren't new divisions. St. Louis, it has racial lines. And like they were talking about, there's areas of St. Louis County that are largely white, and there's areas that are largely black. And it's not something that's going to be solved overnight as far as there's a feeling that because people don't have to necessarily interact on a day-to-day basis, there's a lack of understanding and communication. Kind of got off topic there a little bit, but
I think that's right on, because that's what we've, you know, commonly been hearing from a lot of people, is that this isn't something that is completely new situation. Some are saying it's just a manifestation of something that is already happening in St. Louis. So what other solutions are there other than that dialogue seems valuable? But
well, I mean, at different events, people have said wanted to stay very focused on getting justice for Michael Brown and been upset when there's been other issues raised. But then other people have talked about, you know, underlying causes and problems that need to be addressed in order for the larger issues to change. And one of those is education, another is voting. So there's been people trying to register people in the area, in Ferguson area, to vote this week. And it's something of note, I'm not sure if people in the Columbia area understand or realize, but Michael Brown was a graduate of Normandy High School, which is unaccredited. Well, there's been this whole issue now. It's one of the school districts that for the past year was unaccredited, and now the state has taken over and made it a Normandy Schools Collaborative. So education is another underlying issue that how can we get pair, make sure there's equal opportunities for education and jobs in the future.
Yeah, you mentioned voting as well. Maybe go back to that, because part of the whole conversation has been that, you know, the police department of more than 50 officers, only three of them are black, even though the community is about two-thirds black in Ferguson, and a white mayor, white city manager, if I'm not mistaken, you know, mostly white leadership. So again, I guess that comes back to that voting idea on some of that anyway.
Right. I mean, they wouldn't vote for police chief necessarily.
Right.
There's an understanding that, well, Bob McCullough, for example, the county prosecutor, was just reelected for 4 years, essentially, because he ran for the Democratic primary unopposed, and there's no Republican candidate. Well, I don't know if he was unopposed, but there's no Republican candidate, so he's basically reelected. So there's the idea that if there's more people registered to vote, more people from that area going out to the polls, they can have a greater voice in who their leaders are.
Mm-hmm. We had that, and just the candidates, I guess, is the other side of the thing. In fact, one of the guests we tried to have for the show's been all over the place. He was booked for the show. We may still join us later. We'll see. Antonio French has been someone who's taken on very high profile on Twitter, has been someone documenting what's going on, and also, you know, representing the community as a St. Louis alderman. But that's another thing where that we don't have a lot of candidates like that in that region necessarily.
And it's important to note that Alderman Antonio French is a city alderman. He's not right. One of Ferguson's elected officials, but he is a political figure, and he has been out documenting the protests since the beginning, every night taking video. He's very big social media presence, and it's been a way that a lot of people have been getting their latest news by following him.
Right, right. And so, yeah, I guess, Frank, we just have a few seconds before the break, but is there anything on what we said there you want to pick apart too, I guess, or just that component of leadership in the community is a big part of how some of this stuff will play out, I guess.
Surely, although, I mean, the interesting thing in listening to this conversation, not only here but for the last week, is the degree to which this case, as is so often true when these tragedies occur, becomes a great big Rorschach test where everyone imposes or sees their own particular hobby horses or particular social concerns in the case, or sees the case as an opportunity to raise them, and query whether, you know, this case is ideally suited to raise some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, after more than a week of protests over the police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. Joining us in studio to talk about it, Frank Bowman is a law professor at the MU School of Law. And joining us by Skype, Camille Phillips is a reporter from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Ryan Femuelner. We'll be right back after this short break.
Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. After more than a week of protests over the police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown, we're talking about the current state of the situation as well as the social impact and legal process as the community's crying out for justice now. Joining us in the studio today to talk about the situation in Ferguson and where things go from here, Frank Bowman is a law professor at the MU School of Law. And joining us from St. Louis today, Camille Phillips is a reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. For you and our audience, what questions do you have about the future of the situation in Ferguson? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And we actually have a caller on the line now. We wanted to bring in John from Columbia. John, are you there?
Yes. Good afternoon.
Yes.
Gosh, what a societal tragedy. I don't know the solution, but I guess we can hope for the best. But I do have a question for Professor Bowman. Perhaps he could enlighten me. Friday, the city of Ferguson, the police department, called a press conference to identify the officer who made the shots. And at the time of that release, he also released a video of the strong-arm robbery, which reportedly inflamed this volatile situation. But the police chief subsequently defended his release of the strong-arm robbery in the convenience store, stating that he was directed to do so by the city attorney, that he had freedom of information requests, and he couldn't sit on it any longer. My question for Professor Bowman is, obviously, that was related to the shooting, or he certainly wouldn't have brought it up during the press conference. And two, as I perused the Sunshine Law, I found an exception that evidence being used in a criminal case is exempted from the Sunshine Law. So does the professor have any advice as to the legality, if not the wisdom, of releasing the convenience store video at the time?
Yeah, John, thank you very much. It's a great question. Thank you for calling in.
Well, I'm not an expert on FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. I suspect that you're quite right in your understanding that FOIA would not require the release of material that's directly pertinent to a criminal investigation, certainly not require its release on the timeline that the police chief released it. So I think you're right in that perception. Now, the question then becomes, you know, was he prohibited from releasing it? I think the answer there, too, is no, he's not prohibited from releasing it either.
I will say that one thing, the Department of Justice, there's been reports they actually recommended that video not be released at
Certainly.
This point.
Yeah. But they did that for prudential reasons. They did that because they were concerned that it would inflame the situation. And also, I suspect, I mean, I don't know what they were thinking, but also I think their view is likely to have been that the piecemeal release of investigative information before a final conclusion was reached is just a bad idea. Mm. And once you start down that road, you create all kinds of public relations problems for yourself if you're not more prudent. So I think the release of the tape was probably imprudent by the police chief. Now, that being said, when you consider for the moment the response by some members of the public, and indeed I think the Brown family itself, understandably enough, the reaction was, gosh, this is an attempt at character assassination of mm-hmm. our deceased son, and this shouldn't have happened, and so forth and so on. And while one is certainly sympathetic to that, I mean, there's a certain double standard that was being applied, if you think about it, by the folks who were concerned about what the police did. On the one hand, one of the ostensible reasons for the protests and the rioting was the police's refusal to release the identity of the police officer. And one of the reasons people said they wanted to get that was to find out his past, whether or not he had a disciplinary record and that kind of thing, which is certainly an obvious area of curiosity and may ultimately become a part of the decision about whether or not to prosecute him and so forth and so on. But it's a little inconsistent to say, well, we want everything about the cop so we can make a character judgment about him. But mm-hmm. If you start releasing character past information about the deceased, well, that's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Camille? Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering what you've been hearing on this as well.
One aspect is that while the video of Michael Brown was released, there's been no footage available of Darren Wilson, the officer who was named. And so there's been feelings that it was unfair to release the name and then overshadow it with all this footage of putting Michael Brown in a negative light. Then the other thing is that at first it sounded like the reason why this footage was released was because the officer Darren Wilson stopped Michael Brown as a suspect. Ventilator, the police chief, Thomas Jackson, who's Ferguson police chief, said that, no, in fact, the officer didn't know that he was a suspect at the time of the stop, but then he might have known that there was one and saw him, and later that contributed to it. So there was a little confusion about whether or not the robbery was even involved in the shooting incident. That said, Jackson did say that he felt like he needed to release this information because there were a number of sunshine requests, FOIA requests. There's been back and forth. Governor Nixon definitely said he felt blindsided. He didn't know what was happening. Ron Johnson, the Highway Patrol captain, was also upset about it.
Yeah. Well, and while that was released again at the same press conference as the name of the officer, Darren Wilson, there wasn't any other information. No questions were taken. You know, there's been lots of FOIA requests, I'm sure, for the information about what actually happened after the two, you know, Wilson and Brown were confronted each other, I suppose, whatever, however that played out. And we don't have hardly any answers about how that played out.
Right.
Remember, and there's two separate kinds of issues here. I mean, one is, what do we think about the way in which the press and the public are being managed here, mm-hmm. by both sides, if I can call it that, because this has become an adversarial situation. There's that question. But there's also the question of what, if anything, the information as it comes out tells us. And I start by cautioning, of course, that it's a cardinal mistake to draw any definitive conclusions on partial information. But various people have suggested, for example, that the video and the story is irrelevant to the case. Well, it's plainly not.
Legally, you mean? Yeah.
Well, not only legally, but I think as a matter of common sense, as a matter of, there's a question of what the legal system's going to do, and there's a question of also of letting the citizenry understand as best it can as the investigation proceeds, sort of what this case is about and who's involved and so forth and so on. And the video tells you a number of important things. I mean, first, the timeline is, I think, fairly important. On the one hand, if the time stamp on the video is correct, Mr. Brown left that store having stolen the cigars at 11:54 a.m., and by 12:04, as I understand it, he's already dead. So this is not something that is remote in time. He's been killed probably within 6 or 7 minutes, at most 10, of walking out that door. Whether the officer knew that there had been a robbery or that Mr. Brown was a suspect, plainly Mr. Brown knew that he'd just stolen cigars, that he had just gotten into a physical confrontation with the owner or employee, which is the thing, by the way, that makes that a robbery. Mm-hmm. If I just steal cigars, that's just a shoplift. In Missouri, we call it stealing. It'd be misdemeanor stealing.
It's the confrontation.
The minute I start applying force to get it out the door, that becomes a robbery and becomes a felony. So the point I'm making, I guess, is that we know that Mr. Brown knew that when he walked out of there that he had just committed a crime. And it appears that he encounters a police officer within minutes, if not seconds, after walking out of that door. And that at least gives you something to think about in terms of his state of mind when he may think he's being apprehended or being confronted by a police officer for a felony, even though the officer doesn't know that. It starts to make, I think it at least begins the process of making more sense out of a shooting, which on the face of it makes no sense at all.
Mm-hmm. And again, legally, if this does come to trial with potential charges against against the police officer, this is probably something that, that would be used in court, you think?
Well, I think the there might be an effort to try to exclude it as being irrelevant. I suspect that the prosecution, there's going to be an effort to try to include it. It would really be on probably on behalf of the defense as presenting some sort of an explanation or theory about Mr. Brown's state of mind when he encounters the police officer. Now, it has to be said, and I think this has been reasonably well covered in the media, but it's not always been clear. First, even assuming that Mr. Brown had in fact committed a felony, which he probably did in this case, a police officer cannot apprehend a felon with deadly force unless that felon presents an immediate threat of, you know, violence, serious violence, either the officer or someone else in the community. And one of the things that does seem to be clear from what we, incomplete information we have, is that when the final shots are fired in this case, Mr. Brown appears to have been some considerable distance from the police car where the police officer was shooting. And assuming that that's true, it seems to me that the police officer has got a very, very difficult time in justifying his conduct. Whatever happened in the car, and I think the video, and if you start thinking about the young man's state of mind when he encounters the police officer and so forth, you can think of some pretty plausible reasons why there might be a physical encounter between these two men at the police car. But regardless of what happens there, if Brown gets away from the police officer, moves away, and whether he's running, walking, standing with his hands up, hands down, if he's 20 feet away and he's unarmed, you can't shoot him.
And Camille, from what I can tell from the autopsy results or the preliminary results that have been released in the last couple of days, that's a very plausible situation that he was that far away from the officer when the shots were fired.
Chief Belmar, St. Louis County Police Chief, originally said the whole scene occurred within 35 feet of the police car. However, the police officer was not in the car anymore when the shots were fired. He was outside of the car, so we're not sure the distance he was from Michael Brown at the time of the shooting. The preliminary autopsy appears that it was some distance away because there was not gunshot residue. If I may go back...
If I can interject right there on the gunshot residue point, though, if I understand the preliminary autopsy reports, there's no gunshot residue on the head or anywhere else, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't gunshot residue on some portion of his body that was covered by clothing, because
right.
The preliminary autopsy did not have access to the clothing.
That's correct. It was just the body, not the clothing.
Though importantly, this suggests that since there doesn't appear to be gunshot residue around the head wounds, that those rounds were the fatal ones, were fired when the officer was at least some distance from him. I forget my ballistics from my prosecutorial days, but I think you would have had to have been, someone who knows better will correct me, you know, at least 8 or 10 feet or more away in order for there to be no gunshot residue. Mm-hmm.
And that's the issue that the family and the protesters are wanting to stay focused on, is that the fact that he was unarmed, he was had stopped, is what they're saying, at the time of the shooting. So no matter what happened earlier in the day, the end of the day is that he was unarmed when he was shot.
Right, right. And just to clarify, this autopsy was actually a private autopsy, the one that we're talking about here, done by Michael Baden from New York City. This is an autopsy that usually costs a lot of money to do. He did it for free because of the circumstances of the situation. And again, it's preliminary. They don't have access. This autopsy didn't take into account the other evidence that we have. Again, Camille, your example of the distance that the chief had laid out earlier in some press conferences. This was just purely on the evidence found on the body.
Right.
And they should be able to make some determination about the distance, assuming the crime scene hasn't been disturbed, because the officer presumably is using a semi-automatic, and I understand there were shell casings found, and you can... If the scene hasn't been disturbed, you can make a pretty good calculation of where the shell casings were ejected from, therefore the position of the weapon and rough distance. It's not perfect, but it gives you a good idea.
But again, back to it. I mean, you did the best you could to explain it, but we kind of have to guess at what happened in the car at this point. You know, there were early reports. The police had said that there was a shot fired in the vehicle that didn't hit anyone, and then there was an altercation outside of the car. But that's about the extent of that we've been given on the record from police, and we have some eyewitness testimony as well that gives a different account in some ways. And so I guess that's one thing. Camille, what's been the frustration trying to report this without those facts?
Right, right. There's a lot that's still not known on as far as the actual investigation is concerned. And I must say that even though there's a lot unknown, I will say that from a journalist perspective, we definitely try and push back. And we don't, if we try and feel like we're being controlled, we'll try and go around it. We've had like our reporters on the ground every night. We've been trying to go around and be as much on the scene as possible. It's our job to ask what's not being told. So I would speak on behalf of journalists saying we don't like to be controlled and we will try not to be controlled.
Right. I need to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. After more than a week of protests over the police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown, we're talking about the current state of the situation as well as the social impact and legal process the community is crying out for justice. Joining us in studio today to talk about the situation in Ferguson and where things go from here, Frank Bowman is a law professor at the MU School of Law, and joining us by Skype today, Camille Phillips is a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. We'd love to hear from you and our audience as well. What questions or concerns do you have about the future of the situation in Ferguson? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection at kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And actually, you gave me a good transition to this, Camille. We talked about this briefly. They're going to talk more about it actually on Views of the News later this week on our air. But there have been some journalists that have actually been arrested in the coverage of this story, or at least detained briefly and then released. I don't know, Frank, have you been following that much about those stories? And
yes.
And I guess there's some First Amendment stuff here that I think Camille and I as journalists are very interested in. I think the public is as well. So, yeah, I guess what from what you've seen so far, what's been reported, do you think that the things have been done and there may be more to look into as far as the way the police have handled working with journalists?
Well, I mean, from what I've seen about the arrests of, I think it was a Washington Post reporter and a
Huffington
something, you know, one doesn't know because one was not there, but it just sounds like the police were stupid. I mean, you know, you got to use some common sense here. And the police are undoubtedly feeling under immense pressure and feeling incredibly defensive. And they don't like having you guys look over their shoulders. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they react rather foolishly to that. And that just sounds like one of those instances where they just did a stupid thing. And when they got the reporters down to the station house, some superior said, in effect, look, you meatheads, these guys committed no crime, and kicked them loose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Camille, I wonder, too, your experience with this and maybe some of your colleagues there and other reporters you've talked to.
My colleague, Stephanie Lecce, actually had a pretty scary incident last night. She was on the scene when things got a little hairy, pretty hairy last night, and tear gas was fired on her. She was trying to get away from the chaos. The direction she went, tear gas was fired again, and so she was kind of stuck. She couldn't leave the scene, even though she was trying to get away from the dangerous scene. She encountered some police officers, and they said, "What are you doing here? You shouldn't be here." And she said, "Well, I'm trying to leave, but I can't. And where do I go?" And they basically were accusing or saying that she shouldn't have been on the scene when she was doing her job reporting what was going on. And it wasn't after curfew or anything even, which is another issue entirely in that they were trying to put media in a separate place away from the protests. There was a staging area on Saturday night, sorry. And then there would have been, again, last night, except the main incidents occurred before the curfew even started.
Mm-hmm. And that curfew has been in place, but actually it's supposed to be lifted tonight, is my understanding.
Right. The curfew is not going to be in place tonight.
Right, right. We actually have a comment from Artie Langston. I wanted to bring in real quickly. It goes back to the conversation we were having about the robbery video. He said he might suggest the reason that it was released was actually to poison the jury pool if the officer who perpetrated the shooting is brought to court. What do you think about that? This is obviously something that has, again, international coverage. It's going to be hard to find someone who's not aware of the situation when you are putting together a jury.
Oh, I mean, That seems to me to be a little improbable. I doubt very much that the police chief was looking that far down the road. I suspect he's thinking in a much shorter time frame. He's getting a tremendous amount of pressure. His officer's being accused, perhaps correctly, of a homicide. He's got a piece of information which actually provides a whole bunch of kind of explanatory clues to at least why this confrontation might have occurred, and he wants to get it out there to affect the press coverage and the dialogue. Do I think he's trying to poison the jury pool? No, because in any event, sooner or later this thing was going to come out. It was plainly going to come out before the trial came down, and everybody on the planet is going to have seen it anyway. So, you know, they're going to have a very interesting time, assuming they indict this officer, in getting a jury in St. Louis County to fairly try the case. And one of the things they're going to be asking that jury about when they impanel them and when they select the final jurors out of the veneer is, you know, what have you seen? What haven't you seen? What impressions do you have? Have you formed any biases, prejudices, or preconceptions? But you're going to have to do that regardless, and I think his release at that time had nothing to do with juries and much to do with his current situation.
If I'm not mistaken, evidence is supposed to be presented this week, though, in front of a grand jury. Is that right? Camille, do you know about that?
Yes. Bob McCullough said last week that he was going to call a grand jury within days and start giving them evidence, even as the investigation was ongoing. I've heard that it was going to happen on Wednesday, but I have not confirmed that myself.
Okay. And so in the process, Frank, can you explain where things go, if they go, I guess?
Well, the grand jury is used for a couple of things. I mean, one, it's a mechanism under Missouri law for determination of probable cause, which allows the indictment to proceed or there to be an indictment. But it's also an investigative tool. And it's an evaluative tool. It's one of the reasons you give the case to the grand jury is then the grand jury's decision about whether to indict, whether or not to find probable cause, becomes the ultimate decision. It's not just the prosecutor filing information saying, yeah, I think he did it or I think he didn't do it. The grand jury makes a decision. And oftentimes you get grand juries in high-profile cases for precisely that reason, because it provides a sort of citizen filter to the decision-making process. But it's going to take – it may well take time. I mean, in an investigative situation, sometimes grand juries go on for months or years hearing evidence in the same case. Now, I would not anticipate that would happen here. I assume that McCulloch's going to go forward as expeditiously as he can. But the fact that some evidence is being presented on Wednesday or whatever is no necessary indication that a result will be asked for or an indictment will be sought on that date.
Okay. We just have a few minutes left in the show, and Camille, I thought it might be good to get your take. Just as, again, the situation has continued over the last week, I think many thought things may not last this long, right? So many, especially at night, so much forceful police intervention, all that type of stuff. So what in the short term is the plan? Again, we haven't really mentioned yet in the show, but the other news today is that the National Guard is now involved in the situation, at least at night, and I think during the day as well. So help us understand what might we see coming in the coming days.
Right. A lot will depend on how things play out tonight. I think we'll all be paying very close attention, and that will determine next steps. As far as the bigger conversation, I know all of us at St. Louis Public Radio will be covering this for years to come, and all the underlying issues. You know, how do we heal from this? How do we start crossing some of these boundaries and really come to feel like we're one community?
Right, yeah. Who else has been involved in that? Who will need to be involved in that conversation? I mean, again, it goes well beyond Ferguson, because Ferguson is not a complete outlier in St. Louis necessarily, right?
Right, right. It's a little confusing to people that aren't from St. Louis, but St. Louis City is just 65 square miles. St. Louis County has 95 municipalities. So you call it a suburb, but it's about 20 minutes away from downtown St. Louis, 25 minutes, and it's in a lot of ways urban. And we're one community. You know, there's lots of cities, but we're all one region.
Right, right. And so you're going to ultimately need to have buy-in, I think, from people from a lot of different regions in that one region, I guess, different areas, yeah.
Ongoing. But I think part of the problem is that some people in the African American community, African American leaders, were not part of the conversation or not enough part of the conversation, didn't feel like they were invited to the table sometimes. Or maybe they felt there's some people, I think, that just had given up. And I think that's one opportunity in this tragedy, is that people are impassioned and some people are starting to give their perspectives and want to be involved. And so out of this tragedy, maybe there's hope that we can have greater conversation. And
yeah, I think that's what we heard from Ron Johnson in his speech, and two, in those that point of some people giving up, we heard that a little bit in some of those pieces we played earlier in the show from some youth we talked to in the community, that just even some saying, you know what, I don't think anything's going to change. Yeah, are you hearing that from some people as well on the ground?
I have. I've heard that, you know, some people feel like nothing's going to change. Some people are discouraged because they feel like this is the same thing that's been going on for years. I spoke to a woman who was in her 60s who her family's been involved in the civil rights movement since she was a little girl. And in one hand, she said, you know, this is nothing new. I've seen police. I've been scared of police. I've taught my son to always do exactly what police say and so that he doesn't get hurt. And yet she said, things have changed, you know, laws have changed. It's a different conversation now. It's more about changing hearts and minds and making sure that access is there for everybody.
Yeah. Are there any other barriers you think that need to be overcome in that conversation as well, in that community and things like that? I guess you mentioned some laws that can change. I mean, ultimately it seems like as Camille's saying, a lot of it comes down to just engagement, right?
Yeah. That's something certainly on which I'm no expert. I would say that, you know, it is interesting to reflect about St. Louis, that perhaps that something like this hasn't boiled over before, because it is a profoundly racially segregated metropolitan area, and it was profoundly segregated quite intentionally and for a very, very, very long time until recently. And now what we have is, you know, legal segregation mutating into de facto residential segregation, and with all of the problems that have come with that, and, you know, with all the goodwill in the world, you've got a long, long, ugly history to overcome.
Right. Camille, I saw you wanted to jump in there.
Well, as far as concrete actions, I know that there is a desire to increase diversity training in Ferguson Police Force and extremely push for more diversity in hiring and across the board. Because, I mean, we've talked about how there is evidence of racial profiling, at least in what the Highway Patrol has data on.
Right. Well, we're going to have to end it there, actually, for today's intersection. That's all the time we have. Thanks to our guests. Frank Bowman is a law professor at the MU School of Law, and Camille Phillips joined us by Skype. She's a reporter from St. Louis Public Radio. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast. The intersection takes place live a full hour from 2 to 3 on Monday afternoons. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersections are broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and a project of RJI and KBIA. As a programming note, this is the last time Intersection will air as a regular weekly show. Going forward, the show will air on an irregular basis. We'd like to thank the Reynolds Journalism Institute for its partnership on this show over the years and look forward to working with the Institute on future projects as well. Intersection is produced by Maureen Lewis-Stump. Travis McMillan's our technical director. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.